A Life of Jesus by Brother Melva Purkis. Book 4, Chapter 16. The Women Who Followed. It is possible, but by no means certain, that the penitent woman with flowing hair was none other than Mary Magdalene. We do know that when Jesus continued his journey after this incident in Simon's house, we read that Mary Magdalene was with him, ministering to his needs. It is also not without significance that she is described as the woman from whom Jesus cast 7 devils. It is not profitable to linger too long on this identity, but if Mary of Magdala was indeed the woman who prostrated herself in the Pharisee's house, we can understand the sublime devotion with which she followed her Lord. Love possessed her more completely than the 7 demons had ever done. Who can watch her without deep emotion, as she clings to him day by day and night, following with weary but persistent steps as he strides out over tough mountain and rocky valley? When the inevitable storm breaks over him, and the thunder rolls across the sky, we see her horrified face illuminated for an instant in the lightning flash. And she is clinging more closely still. At last she can follow him no further. She stands near the foot of the cross, her haggard eyes still seeking her dying Lord. Even his death could not separate her from him. With unfailing loyalty, she followed behind those who carried him to his tomb. While bewildered disciples mourned their weakness, she watched where he was laid. On the first day of the week, she faced an empty grave. Her cry of despair tugs at every heartstring. "They have taken away my Lord, and I know not where they have laid him." But when she thought he was furthest away from her, he was nearest to her. And at last she learned the greatest lesson of her life. He taught her that although her physical eyes may not behold him, although her clasping fingers could not touch him, although she might not hear the rich accents she loved so well, he was with her always, to the end of the world and beyond. Great as was the work of Jesus in easing men's physical load, healing their sickness, restoring their sight, the life of Mary Magdalene shows that it was not so great as his unseen work in the heart of man. No miracle can be more wonderful to the discerning mind than the picture of the woman lost in the lowest degradation of sin, transformed into a saint glowing with a love too deep to express. It is both a comfort and an incentive to realize that while the hand of the Redeemer is no longer lifted in gentle ministration to take away our physical infirmities, his greater work goes on. No abyss of sin and despair is too deep or too dark for him to reach. No heart too cold to warm into devoted love and service. There were many other women who followed him in Galilee, ministering to him of their substance. Susanna is mentioned by name. There was also Joanna, the wife of Cusa, Herod's steward. This woman may have been the wife of the Capernaum court official, whose son Jesus had healed by a word spoken at Cana. If that is so, it was a beautiful way of showing her gratitude, and one which must commend itself to her sisters for all time. Although their Lord is no longer in their midst, it is still possible for them to follow him, and minister to him of their substance in conscious response to his blessings. He is yet to show the lovely significance of a cup of cold water and the precious secret of his identity hidden in the lonely, the suffering, and the needy. It is a blessed truth that the Master still makes it possible for devoted women to follow him beside the gleaming lake and on the solitary road which leads to Jerusalem, inspiring all men by their loyalty and their love, and leading many to his feet. When Jesus reached Capernaum from his long journey through the cities and villages of Galilee, the people brought to him one possessed who was also blind and dumb. The afflicted man was restored, and those who witnessed the miracle were amazed and said, "Is not this the son of David?" Such incidents happened daily at this period of Christ's ministry, but Mark adds a fact which is probably the reason for its prominence. He tells us that scribes who had come down from Jerusalem intervened to challenge Christ. It would seem that the popularity of Jesus was becoming so disturbing, particularly after the resurrection at Nain, that a deputation was sent quickly from Jerusalem to use its considerable power in an effort to check it. These scribes lost no time in launching their campaign against him. Their attack was more subtle than may be at first apparent. They could not deny that Christ was performing miracles, but they could question the source of his power. Miraculous powers and the ability to expel unclean spirits were commonly claimed among the Jews at that time, and such activities were countenanced by the scribes and Pharisees. Their point of attack was not, therefore, on whether Christ performed miracles, but by what power he worked. "This fellow," said they, "doth not cast out devils, but by Beelzebub, the prince of the devils." How quickly and decisively Jesus confounded them. What paltry figures they made, confronted by his truth and purity. If their allegation was true, then the kingdom of Beelzebub must be in considerable confusion. It was obviously doomed to fall in its state of civil war. How can it be otherwise if, in the name of Beelzebub, he is freeing men from the domination of Beelzebub? To add to their perplexity, Jesus went further. "Your disciples cast out devils too. In whose name do they cast them out?" Obviously their power could not be from the same source, or they would be bound in honour to believe in him. "Let them be your judges." Having reduced their challenge to absurdity, with irresistible logic, Jesus brought home to them the only alternative. "But if I cast out devils by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God is come unto you." He went even further. In coming to bring the kingdom of God, Jesus had come to engage in mortal combat with the devil and his works. Sin in all its ramifications had to be stamped out. He would achieve that finally when his hour had come. His work with those who were afflicted with the terrible effects of sin was an earnest of that coming victory. He was entering into the strong man's house and spoiling his goods. To do that, he needed the power of God to bind the strong man. He required also the faith of those he released. Otherwise, his work for them could only fail. "He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth abroad." But Jesus had not yet finished with those men. He had shattered their attack. Now he turned from his own defence to denounce them. It was brief, but it was terrible. Every one of them must have gone cold with fear as he convicted them. Without answering him a word, they went their way. There is something far worse than a lack of faith, which is, after all, only passive opposition to the working of the Spirit of God. Jesus was faced with an active, organized opposition, which for selfish reasons sought to work on the side of the enemy Christ had come to destroy. It not only denied him the Spirit of God, but attributed his power to Satan. That was something which could never be forgiven. Blasphemy against the Son, evil as that was, could be repented of. But to speak against God by denouncing his Spirit as evil was to be guilty of eternal sin and to be forever unpardoned. This dreadful indictment the scribes brought upon themselves, because, says Mark, they said, he hath an unclean spirit. It was on this occasion that Christ's mother and brethren came to Capernaum and asked for him. His attitude to them suggests that their mission sought in some way to impede his ministry. Whether it was that Mary had heard of the concerted efforts which were being made against him, and, moved by fear and affection, was anxious to persuade him against continuing his work, we do not know. But it seems certain, from his apparent refusal to see her, that the maternal instinct was pressing strongly still, in spite of two rebukes which had already wounded her sensitive spirit. We find it hard to criticize a mother's protective and possessive instinct. The sword must pierce her soul once more. Jesus does not condemn her, his mother, but he is still about his Father's business. His whole life is dedicated to founding a spiritual relationship far exceeding the bounds of earthly ties. He can no longer acknowledge their authority. It is for them to acknowledge his. It is unhappily significant that they waited outside, desiring him to come to them. It could never be so. They could go to him. He could never come to them. Behold, my mother and my brethren. For whosoever shall do the will of God, the same is my brother and my sister and mother.